Today is Thursday, January 26th, 2023. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. And Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
Well, I'm nearly 85 years old, which tells you something.
Well, it's lovely to hear your voice.
Thank you.
Last time we left off with your exploration of what was called at the time, I think, Paiute Cave, a fairly large cave complex and possibly the deepest in the state?
At that time, it was surveyed as the deepest in the state, I believe, barely surpassing, I believe, one of the crevice caves in the region southeast of Flagstaff.
Okay.
It was not, I think, actually exceeded in depth in Arizona until the quite recently found Shinumo Caves, which are large enough to, I think, double whopper, maybe 600 some feet in depth.
And I'm just going to digress for a minute. Do you think that Double Whopper and Shinumo, are those larger in size than, say, Lechuguilla Cave?
I know, but they're getting into, well, actually the closest one in the west that's presently neck and neck with Double Whopper at more than 40 miles is the Snowy River Breakthrough in Fort Stanton Cave in south central New Mexico. They're extremely different types of caves in terms of speleogenesis, but they both have a quite lengthy survey of passages.
40 miles is a long ways to be underground, and I'm thinking these are sort of week-long or multi-week-long expeditions where you're camping underground for day after day.
Lechuguilla in the 80s and 90s, we were indeed camping for up to 6 to 7 days in the cave, which it took a while to get the park to approve of that. But once they did, we all agreed that it was both pleasanter and safer to do it with camping at regularized your schedule and gave time for decent sleep and so on.
Yes.
And it's been more recently instituted in Snowy River, but the camp has only been used a time or two because there's been so much flooding in the cave, and when it does that, you can't explore into it. Some of the areas are sumped or nearly sumped, and the condition of the Snowy River white floor decoration becomes softer when it's wet. So we've had about half the time in recent years where it hasn't been feasible to continue. We've been delayed in Fort Stanton, where at least in the Bopper Caves, the primary controller, I think, is the simple difficulty of getting to them, and people do have to be very strong, competent cavers in both cases.
Mentally and physically, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to speaking with you about that in the interviews ahead. But today, let's continue on with that same time period of Paiute Cave. Can you sort of set the general scene of this? This is 1965-ish, 65-66. You were living in California, but it seemed like your heart was at the Grand Canyon.
Yes, I had gotten hooked on it in 63, and I mean really hooked. I was obsessed with it and wanted to spend as much time there as possible. But not being wealthy, I had limitations on what I could manage to do.
Okay.
That's one of the good things about caving, is that's one of the very few remaining pursuits that a person can do, where you can do actual geographical exploration, discover new things, without having to go undersea or in outer space. So normal human beings can actually go out for weekends or longer if they're prepared for that and do this exploration with minimal expense.
That's a really good point, to be able to explore the last frontier.
Yes.
Fairly inexpensively, with some risk, but there's always that risk in any frontier exploration.
Although with caving, at least, unlike river running, which is dynamic, and you need to be quick and able to judge things very quickly and easily. And whereas with caving, the cave, as a rule, just sits there at its own pace, and you have time to approach hazards or challenges and think about them as long as you might want to before committing yourself. And it's rare to commit to a move in caving that you can't reverse if it doesn't look safe.
Nice. So in that time period, 65, 66, you very kindly sent me a couple of PDFs. One is a summit list that you compiled in 1966 of a number of the named summits and who climbed them. In a first recorded way, because some of these points or some of these buttes were undoubtedly climbed, or many of them, by indigenous peoples, because you didn't need a rope. You, with good scrambling skills, you could simply walk up these places.
Not always walk up, but at least scramble up all your limbs.
But some of them, I think of Siegfried Pyre, Mount Sinala. Now we're starting to get a little more difficult in these types of where there's a tower sort of structure, where it's a little more difficult to ascend.
The worst I have seen among all the named peaks in the canyon was Excalibur in the Shinumo Amphitheater. It's a needle, really, and overhangs. A block of Coconino overhanging the hermit underneath.
Exactly.
I still don't understand how in heck anyone climbed it, but I know they have.
Yes, yes. And just the very fact that these towers are standing is puts one back on one's heels a little bit, wonder how these things are there. Near Excalibur is Elaine Castle.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether you've spoken about Elaine.
I don't think I have in the interviews yet.
Maybe we could do that. Do you remember, did you do the standard approach from the North Rim for that?
Yes.
And then you must have... in that case, you must have gone past Excalibur, or at least seen it.
That's presumably one of the places I saw it from.
Okay.
It wasn't that close.
And then Elaine and King Arthur, I believe, is another nearby summit.
Yes, I never made it over to that one.
Okay. Did you go out to climb Elaine by yourself?
Yes. That was solo. I was looking in my records. I undoubtedly have a report on it, but I hadn't run back into it, so I'm not quite sure about the dating there until I find out.
Okay. All right. And do you remember anything about it, just as we're talking, that you found unusual, or was difficult, or was easy, or surprising?
Unusual, yes, absolutely. I got up to 20 feet below the actual summit flat, which was a little Coconino slab, I think Coconino anyway, flat on top. And 20 feet underneath that was an overhang with an Indian wall built across it.
Hmm.
I have not personally encountered such a thing at that level on any of these summits, but it rather flabbergasted me because I tried to imagine, what's this doing here? Why would they build something so far up there? And it seems that these sorts of things are more often than not interpreted as defensive works in some way or other. But that puzzled me because, as far as I could tell, there was only one easy route up Elaine Castle, and it seems as if the enemies came along the platform below. If you tried to go up there and hold out against them, it seems as if all they'd need to do would be sit down under the thing and wait until your water ran out and then kill you.
Right, and that certainly could have happened. That type of siege warfare happened in Europe enough and other parts of the planet. But I guess another rationale would be, well, I can at least hold out a little while, hopefully until my friends can show up and beat these bad guys back.
Yeah, that's the thought. I hadn't thought about that either, but it's worth entertaining.
And, you know, it's hard to, you know, put our minds, our 21st century minds, into that type of life.
It would be interesting to know who the enemy was in this case. It was an inter-tribal Pueblo clashing, or was it maybe ancestral Apache and nomads coming through, and in the latter case, maybe holding out on it would be a little more sensible, since the enemy might not be there all that long. They might move on rather than try to mount a siege.
And if I wanted to be creative, I'd say, well, I'm day after day, month after month, year after year, living where there's food, shelter, clothing, and I have to deal with ants and mice and scorpions and all the other creatures that are feeding off of me and my detritus. Maybe I'm just going to build a little place, a second home, if you will, up someplace high, and occasionally I'm going to go up there with the family, and we will be pest-free for a night or two, and then I'm going to go back to my normal local digs. I mean, I think trying to stir the pot of possibilities here.
Yes, I've had similar ideas, not exactly the pest-free part, but maybe those people aren't so different from us as we suppose. Maybe some, at least, of them actually enjoyed the magnificent views in the Grand Canyon and had themselves a little summer house, or maybe spring and fall, considering the climate, but a place where they could spend time and gaze out across everything, and while perhaps at the same time having a view of potential enemies moving around below.
Or game, or food,
exactly,
you know,
true.
Down below. So, and some of these Puebloan structures are in locations that have incredible views, and that fits right into what you're saying is, gosh,
why? That's the most spectacular viewpoint one I've ever seen.
Was which one?
The Elaine.
Was the Elaine. Oh, wow. I haven't seen there. And so was that just an out and back in a day for you? Or did you camp out there?
No, I didn't camp. It was a relatively fast ascent and return. I'm sure I was only there during one day.
Okay.
I had gone by, though, before that, coming out of Shinumo. I think it was an earlier trip, and I set my eye on that summit.
Also in this list, you actually did some hiking with Harvey Butchert.
Oh, yes.
Do you have a rough idea when your first hike with Harvey was, and how did that come about?
I don't recall which one actually was the first, but it came about because after my trip in 1963 below the rim at the Peets, I somehow had learned about Harvey Butchert's existence. I don't remember if the Arizona Cavers told me of him or someone in the park might have, but he sounded like someone that I would be interested to know and potentially get to do trips with. So in 1964, I wrote Harvey Butchert a letter, handwritten, that initial thing, and introduced myself, expressed my interest in things, and I think I had some questions for him already, so that started a correspondence that lasted for many years.
Nice.
But when we actually began to do things together, it didn't work all the times I would have liked it to, because it was such a long trip for me to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I vaguely recall that I did probably half a dozen or possibly more trips with Harvey Butcher.
Can you recount a few of those, or as many as you can?
Well, it would have helped if I had restudied all of my records and made some notes, but I, at least one of them was apparently to Alsap and Novinger Buttes, which were unclimbed at that time on the records. But I am puzzled there because I can't find any log for either my end or his end of the trip we made there. There was a note elsewhere in my record that I was there with him in a particular date, and I think, let's see, the year though is out of my recollection, although it's in my record. In fact, in what I sent you, email.
Right. I don't see dates on these. I just see that this is just the list.
That's right. I was asked to refine that by adding the dates, and I haven't finished that.
Okay.
I don't think I put that in your packet of email.
Right. And so what do you remember about the Alsop-Novinger hiking with Harvey?
I don't recall Alsop in particular, but Novinger was quite interesting in a way, because when one went partway up Novinger on the Redwall limestone, and I encountered a cave entrance in the Redwall in Novinger Butte, and I guess I had a light of some sort because I went in at least a couple of hundred feet to an end of essentially a single passage cave.
Okay.
But there was no sign that anyone had been there before. And then the summit itself, of course, was a virgin peak for at least our era of exploration. So I am the only person I know who has had both of those most esteemed goals of these disciplines in the case of mountaineering. doing an unclimbed peak, and in the case of caving, doing a virgin cave, or at least a cave that had not been made known to our culture.
Mm-hmm. In the same day.
Yes. Same walk.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. What was Harvey like to hike with?
I enjoyed hiking with him. He and I were a pretty decent match in terms of speed and how much we could handle in a day. And he had sort of interesting habits. In some ways, he was accustomed to carrying a Reader's Digest issue with him on camping trips, and when he was ready to go to bed, he'd read in the Reader's Digest. And I think for a time in his early activities there, had a habit of burying his tin cans. A lot of his food was in tin cans. And I don't think I cared for that, and I might have reproved him a bit on it. I don't know if it changed his custom.
And I'd heard that he would rip out the pages of the Reader's Digest that he had read and leave them in overhangs. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Quite true. I didn't see that.
Okay. It
doesn't clash with anything.
And that he would cover a good amount of ground in a day.
Yes.
And that suited you good, sounds like.
Yes, although actually the two longest day hikes I've ever done were both at the Grand Canyon. One pretty early, I think, in fact, in 1965, I hiked up Diamond Creek from the mouth of Peach Springs Wash on the Hualapai Reservation in the Western Canyon.
Yep.
Because all of those were karst springs coming out of Mua, which are typically, actually it was unclear off the south rim, but most of them were from the Mua of limestone.
Mm-hmm.
But they could be from the red wall in the canyon across on the south side.
Right.
So I wanted to check whether I could find a cave that stream might come out of.
Okay.
And that was quite a rewarding and strenuous hike. And so a little bit up that canyon, it got into a Precambrian system, nice, and
yep,
quite a deep slot. And I gave it a name for myself there, the Black Isle.
Oh, nice.
It was such a narrow and black thing. And going in along there, the stream was averaging about 4 feet wide. And I encountered a water ouzel, or a dipper, as some bird books call these little fowl.
Mm-hmm.
And they are extremely obsessive about remaining close to the fast water that they live and feed in. And this bird kept flying ahead of me as I walked up the narrows there. And I apparently was driving it away from its normal territory. And rather cruelly, I decided to walk as far as I could to see if that bird would ever fly back past me. And it got very agitated, and obviously it wanted to, but it didn't want to get close enough to me to go past, because it would have had to go back too far from the stream.
Huh.
And this is the smallest stream I've ever seen one of those birds inhabit. But after 2 miles of this, I had mercy. I just thought, gosh, am I going to kill this bird? It's so obsessive that it won't pass me and might die first. So I just stepped back a couple of yards from the stream, and it immediately flew zip down again.
Oh, my gosh. Huh.
So I hope I didn't actually harm it, but I couldn't help, wondering what it would be willing to do. So anyway, on that hike, that was my most continuous long hike, in that I never even stopped to eat. I took my can out of my gas mask bag and opened it while walking, and even ate it while walking without resting. And I ended up gaining, I think, something like 2,000 or 3,000 feet of elevation in 10 miles. And when I came to the springs, finally, they didn't issue from open cave mouths. If I'd had longer time and energy, I might have gone above them a ways to see if there might be dry entrances from an earlier phase of the spring, but I didn't do that. I later found that there was a cave up above there in the red wall, an ancient dry cave that has been called Diamond Cave because it's about 1,000 feet long and totally lined with calcite crystals.
Oh, wow.
Now, that one's historical and has 1800s signatures and things, if I recall correctly.
Huh?
And then, of course, I walked back down to Peach Springs Lodge, having completed 20 miles of walking and without even taking a rest. And then the other one was from...
Hey, Donald.
Yes.
Can I ask you a few questions about that Diamond Creek hike?
Yeah, oh, sure. Sounds as though you've been there. You recognize the Black Isle.
I have, and I was very fortunate to be there at a time when the creek had recently flashed. And so a lot of the tamarisk that could choke the drainage itself and make, you know, the small willow, coady willow, some of the, especially when there's water, can be very brushy and difficult to travel in, but it had flashed, and so the walking was easy until I got to a major fork where the water was coming from the north and the flash had come from further east. And that slowed me down enough that I ended up turning around, and I never even got up to the to the spring. So you clearly did better than I did on that day.
It hadn't had flash flood any time recently that I could see.
Okay. Well, you did well to get up that far. And then I actually found signs of recent human habitation and wondered if you had seen any of that at all. People can't, you know, signs of people camping, fires, cut trees, sorts of things.
No.
Okay.
I never saw any sign that anyone but me had been there.
Okay. All right. Yeah, those are only my questions about that. But yeah, that's a really nice, the Black Isle it's a short little section. It's not, you aren't in the nice for very long there. It makes a nice little, narrows a little waterfall that was in there. It was kind of nice on a hot day.
Yes, luckily there are no overhang waterfalls to stop you.
Right. Okay, and then your next long day hike, where was that?
That was from Desert View to the overlook between Little Colorado and the main river drainages. And
Cape Solitude.
Yes, Cape Solitude, and if I figured it correctly, I did about a 15-mile trip to get there. I was some 600 feet of elevation drop and regain, and then back the same distance, so I counted that as a 30-mile day hike.
That is huge. Wow. And that's a lot of that journey. At least the second part of it out to the point is through over some wonderful sand country. It's just sand, and so it makes for some challenging fast walking.
I remember getting onto a back road at one point out there that covered a good deal of the distance.
Yeah, back in the day. Well, this would have been before that was heavily fenced. And So people were driving out there. This is certainly in the 60s. Things weren't quite so closed up as they would get.
I don't remember any fences out that way.
Okay.
I also went down the Blue Spring Trail to see what kind of springs were feeding all that travertine and salt water into the main river. And that, at the time I noted this, that was about the most extreme route that I'd ever seen designated as a trail with a name. The Coconino, you just had to zigzag along the ledges following across bedding plains, and it didn't do that anywhere but in the Coconino, I guess. But still, I was glad it was doable at all without safety rope. And the springs down there were quite intriguing. They welled out of caves on both sides of the canyon, but the caves were full of water that they were pumping out. And there were several outlets, at least, not just the one spring that then was on the top of the map. But above that spring, which came out of just a little hollow cavelet that had a water line inside that showed there was apparently not much fluctuation in the water flow. Just on top of the nose that cave mouth was under, I found a stash of stuff that had been left apparently by some kind of survey team that included a metal object 15 inches or so long that had the label on it, water demineralizer, and then some canned food that was from apparently the 1920s or 30s and had remarkably low prices stamped on the can. I remember 17 cents, that sort of price on this food. And I left all that stuff in place, if I remember correctly.
There was an attempt to do some dam surveying there, the geological survey. And I wonder if that could have been part of that, but, well, not necessarily. I was kind of wonder. I wanted to back up just a minute to your Cape Solitude walk from Desert View. Did you walk over to Comanche Point on that walk, or were you focused on on going to Solitude and therefore were a little further east and staying away from the Palisades until you got to Solitude?
I do not remember going over to Comanche Point, although I do remember that it's in my summit list, but I don't recall who I recorded as having been there.
Okay. Because that certainly would have added more time to your 30-mile day.
Yes, but I think I realized I was as far out there as I ought to go. Only recently I've read an account of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and I thought my 30 miles was really a long hike, but some of those people in their Lewis and Clark trips would walk much farther than that in a day, and they didn't always have shoes either.
Right. The indigenous runners would go way farther. Of course, they were jogging, during the day. They're just jogging along. But still, it just the feats of human endurance are amazing. But just simply walking from Desert View out to Comanche Point and back, or to Cape Solitude. Yeah, just going to Comanche and back is a good enough wander. There's no water out there. You've got to carry all your water. That's a challenge.
I should reread my account of that, and maybe I did go on to Comanche Point proper.
Yeah, I would just assume at one point you would have walked out there.
I think from Solitude I could look across the river and see fragments of the airliner that had crashed on that far side a few years ago.
Right. This would have been in the 60s that you were there?
Probably. That's another one that somewhat eludes my recollection.
Okay. And then for the Blue Springs exploration, can you give me your thoughts about what kind of caving potential there could be in that area? That's a huge amount of water. It's year round. It doesn't go up in the spring and down in the winter when it's dry. And I kind of can only fathom what kind of cave potential there must be in there.
Yes, I've thought about that quite a lot, as well as similar thoughts about Havasu Canyon. There has to be just a gigantic capacity aquifer there, if only because of the very nearly steady output from those springs. But the problem is that at least in the near zones, it's probably completely full of water.
Okay.
Need to dive. And in fact, I told a diver, Sheck Exley, about those springs, and he got one of the NSS conventions that he attended, I think, and he actually had a ranger friend in the park at that time, and the two of them went down there some decades back and actually dived in the springs, but he only got, I think, 80 feet or so at the most into one cave. He had just a little pony tank, as they called them. And then more recently, just a few months ago, some other cavers went and dived in some of the springs and wrote it up in the NSS News. I had to send a correction because they were unaware about Exley's earlier trip there. They were assuming that they were the first to dive there, and they were not.
But they were trying to explore the hydrologic features of the Blue Springs.
Well, they're at least trying to see if they could go very far into the caves, and I don't think they made it much farther than Exley, although actually I think they did get a bit farther. I think they were on the opposite side of the river from what Exley was doing.
Okay.
But the travertine dams there are average only four or so feet high, but they cross the entire width of the Little Colorado Valley. And I suspect that if that didn't get periodic major surface floods
right
going down and tearing things up, they would probably have built up bigger travertine dams than the travertine in Havasu Canyon.
Oh, interesting.
The flow is much larger.
Interesting.
But the aquifer certainly is extensive. And
yes.
The water, I have drunk the water from it. It's drinkable, although not exactly fresh tasting. But I drank from the Little Colorado when I went on the river trip in 1981. I drank about a half gallon of that water, and I actually slept better that night than any other night on that trip.
Interesting.
Well, somebody has told me that the springs are high in lithium, which apparently can have a sedative effect like that.
Oh, is that right? Huh.
That's what I was told. I don't know how right it really is.
I don't know either.
It tasted saline enough.
The Little Colorado River watershed is massive, so it makes sense that there is a lot of water moving underground or subsurface.
Although I think the actual aquifer for these caves is far wider than just something close to the surface outcrop of a given stream. Most of the water, I think, comes from farther south, where there are higher mountains and where there's more getting into the aquifer.
Hmm. Interesting.
But I wouldn't assume that just the surface topography in the Little Colorado Basin has a whole lot to do with the permanent springs.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I know here in Flagstaff, the runoff here goes to the Little Colorado River, which is, you know, way north of us. So, and of course, the basin itself goes all the way to New Mexico. And again, it's a huge amount of country out there.
Yes. So, there's a professional hydrologist named Peter Huntoon, who for a time, I think, was associated with the Western Speleological Institute people.
Okay.
And he has written professional papers on the hydrology of the Grand Canyon and the caves in particular. And those interested in Grand Canyon hydrology should look up Peter Huntoon's publications before anything else. In fact, he and I did a joint item for the Cave Encyclopedia 20 years or so ago about the Grand Canyon speleogenesis and hydrology. And it was flattering to me that he would even want to collaborate with me about it, but he did.
Oh, that's nice. Let's go back to Harvey for a minute. You must have visited with Roma,
yes.
His wife, R-O-M-A.
Yes, visited maybe a little strong. She paid me little mind while I was there.
Okay.
But as others, I think, have noted, Roma, I think, saw the Grand Canyon as a rival for her affections, as it were.
Yep.
She didn't seem that happy a lady.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I wondered about that. What other hikes do you remember of walking with Harvey?
Well, the Gunther Castle climb was the longest one, I think.
Where did you start that from? So you would have crossed the river with your air mattresses?
Oh, no, no. Gunther Castle is on the... I'm sorry. What I called the east rim, I meant the east rim of the north side.
Thank you. That just threw me. I was thinking, oh, okay, well, it went down the Tanner, they crossed, and off they went. And
no.
No, okay. Okay.
Yeah, let's see.
Off the Cape Royal Road... somewhere.
Gunther Castle, yeah. We succeeded in getting up to the top of Gunther Castle, only to discover that we'd been cheated of our ascent in that we found a surveyor stake and some wire on top of the summit there. And that's a period when this well-known, much publicized surveyor was resurveying part of the Grand Canyon and doing landings on summits by helicopter. So
right.
We assume that he was responsible for that.
Okay.
That sort of angered us that he left his trash there instead of taking it away. The least he could have done if he was going to land on something virgin.
Right. Set up their backsites and left them. And then flew away to set up foresights and work their survey along, but did not clean up. So, yeah.
I think that was in 1969.
Did you do an overnight for that, or was that a day off the rim?
That was an overnight, and in fact, we split the party. There were four of us. And Harvey and River Inn, where Clarence Ellis, or otherwise known as Doc Ellis, was with me. And we spent the night in the Juneau Ruin, a Pueblo ruin whose walls were still half standing in the Lava Creek Basin. And then we were heading out, and we were going to go up to head of Lava Canyon and then up the Coconino to the north of that area. And so after sleeping down there, we had hiked about 2 miles when we came abreast of a large natural bridge or natural arch in the Red Wall, which had been, I think, called the Goldwater Arch.
Or the Kolb Arch, yeah.
Kolb Arch.
But you're right, Goldwater got the first write-up on that. Well,
so,
there's a...
The Cave Research Associates had mentioned that arch as... They interpreted it as a remnant of a Red Wall cave that at one time might have actually crossed Lava Canyon. So I looked across Lava Canyon, and there was a cave mouth up there, not a very big one, but I figured, well, this might, in fact, have been a continuation across a canyon that has since eroded through it. So I decided to go check it out. It was maybe a 450-foot climb up to it, and Doc Ellis elected to stay and rest at the bottom. So I climbed up there and found an opening not much bigger than a human door. I stepped inside, and there was this chamber in there, opening to the right and being about a dozen feet across. And what did I see but a row of prehistoric Indian pots.
My.
All lined up along the little ledge on the wall there, that each had a sandstone slab shipped to fit the individual pot that they were made lids for, and within slabs of limestone on top to hold them down. And all of these are obviously completely untouched. So I first turned around and yelled down to him, "Get your camera up here!" And he got up there, and in the meantime I had looked into each pot by very carefully lifting the lid, and enough that I could see if there were contents, and putting it back on exactly as it had been in orientation. And the first two were empty. The third one had, these big ones were corrugated grayware, the utility type of pottery. And the third one was not as big as some, but had down inside it three small black-on-white painted pots. One of them with a handle like a pitcher or jug, and the zigzag design, typical of the ancient Pueblo pottery. And then the fourth pot, which I actually measured with a tape I had along, was 19 inches wide and 19 inches high.
Wow.
And yet it had the smallest neck of all of them, only about 4.5 inches across, internal diameter.
Wow, it's beautiful.
And down in the very bottom was this single little perfectly preserved twilled, as the archaeologist later called it, basket, about the size that would fit down the entrance without deforming. Rather intricate design, the way it had been assembled. And outside these pots, there was a bundle of canes about 3 feet or 3.5 feet long, which had evidently been made at one point into some kind of mat, because each cane had a tiny hole drilled through it about 2 inches back from the outer end, and they had been strung together with cotton string, very delicate, but that string had deteriorated and the bundle had come to pieces, but looked as if something, maybe they had made it for a bed or something of the sort of pad to lie down on when they wanted to rest. And so I was a good boy and I didn't keep any of these for myself. Although when I went back to Harvey's house after that and talked with them, the aroma butcher, they told me, "You're a fool not to have kept those for yourself."
Oh.
But I disagreed with her. I've always felt that these things were not put there for me.
Right.
And that I was privileged just to have this rare opportunity for a white man at that period to find undisturbed, spectacular artifacts of that kind, and to have a lifelong memory that I treated them as well as I knew how at the time, which at that time did involve reporting to the proper authorities who were the archaeologists, presumably. So I did report it to the park, and a few weeks later, they got a helicopter down to the nearest landing point and did collect the artifacts. And for a while, they showed them in the South Rim Village Visitor Center just behind a rope. I was rather alarmed at that because they had little protection from that, and any random visitor could have reached over and either stolen one or broken it. And,
wow.
But apparently they survived until they ended up in the collections, where I hope they still are.
Mm-hmm.
That was the second most spectacular artifact find that I made in the canyon area, the first being Paiute Cave.
Yeah. Can you tell me about Clarence Ellis, about Doc Ellis?
I didn't really get to know him as a person very well. I don't recall where he came from, but I do remember that when I was back in Colorado a little afterward, we did do a 14er or two with each other, but didn't stay in touch after that.
Okay. And I imagine Harvey was, and Al Doty were irritated that they hadn't stayed with you guys and gone your way.
Oh, well, if they were, I never was told that. The only one who seemed emotional about it was Roma, and her emotion was negative.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an honor thing to find. And
we did get up the Coconino back to the rim on that trip, and that went by fairly close to Siegfried Pyre, which I knew had not got a record yet of a climb. But we didn't have time that day to diverge over to it. And so the following year, in 1970, I joined with Robbie Babb, who was primarily a caving friend.
How do you spell his name?
R-O-B-B-I-E-B-A-B-B.
Thank you.
And he was from New Mexico at the time. We had done at least one bit of winter mountaineering in Colorado. We had climbed Mount Yale in January when it turned out to be 3 below on top when we came out up. Anyway, he was also interested in climbing and not just caving. But somehow I got him to come back to the canyon with me in 70 and do that. Siegfried.
Can you talk me through that again? You would have started on the North Rim, and
yes. I don't recall what route we took down to the saddle, though. But my log would no doubt explain it if I could find it.
And then what was the climb like?
I don't remember the climb being especially long or difficult. But what was on top was what I did remember and always have. There was a gigantic, in terms of girth, pinyon pine on the very summit point itself, which must have been 4.5 feet thick through the trunk near the ground.
Wow.
And maybe 12 or so feet high. And it was in decent health at the time, if I recall correctly, and still green. And I wondered at the time, how did you live up here? I mean, this must have been struck by lightning.
Yeah.
More than once. And, but it had to that point.
Hmm. That's amazing. Huh. Yeah, I would think lightning would have been very, very difficult, but clearly not. Hmm.
Maybe it was just thick enough that any one stroke wouldn't damage a large part of its vascular system.
That would have to be the case. Yeah. Yeah. Hard to figure that one out. Did you get out sort of in the central part of the canyon on the south side? I'm thinking Great Thumb and that area out there.
Yes. Harvey Bushert had told me, I think, about the Interlaid Point route that was said to go down toward the river in that area. And I'd never been that far over along the south rim, so I wanted to have a look at that area.
Okay.
And I don't remember a lot about the descent. I only went down as far, I think, as the, was it the Coconino or the Red Wall? I'm not quite clear now. But what I most remember about that was that it must have been in the spring because the cacti were blooming, and there's this one cactus that's widespread in the southwest, one of what they call claret cup cacti.
Okay.
A kind of serious Trigloschidiatus variety, melanocanthus, I think, in the scientific name. And these are normally a claret, they're very orange-red, bright flowers in that species, but there was a clone down there that were having purple flowers, I remembered. And to this day, I've never heard of any other population of that species having purple flowers. I rather wish I had broken the law and taken a cutting from one and grown it.
Huh.
But a botanist, naturalist, ever wants to find that clone of cacti, that's where they can do it.
That's amazing. Now, had Harvey done that route before, or was he still at that time working on finding that route?
I think he may have been working on completing it.
Okay. And at the top of the route, there's a dwelling, there's a big wall on that, there's a little tower that's broken off the main Kaibab escarpment, and there's a wall on that top of that tower facing the a small gap, and then the main Kaibab platform there.
Now that's a new one to me, I didn't notice it.
Okay, that's right there near the top of that route. And so it sounds like that hadn't appeared on Harvey's radar screen by that time. I'm sure he would have pointed it out to you.
One of my last major Grand Canyon activities was out that way also, but farther out onto the Esplanade below Great Thumb area. But that was so far into my career that maybe that should wait for a later interview to describe.
Okay. Well, maybe
it was in 1984, in fact.
Okay. Yeah, let's hold that for a bit. Maybe this is a good place. We've been talking for about an hour. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series.
You see fit.
Is there anything else in the ground you have just covered that you want to bring in at this time?
My summit record includes castor abuse, which is the only, well, no, not the only one. I also claimed an ascent of Ayer Point.
Okay.
But castor is off the south rim, too, and those are the only two named summits on that side that I climbed. Most of the others are, or all of the others are off the north side.
Okay.
Other than that, I did a bit of caving off the south rim, and actually that could also merit recording here. That I rappelled to two caves, three actually, that required grappling hook techniques, or rappelling off the top of the red wall to get into their entrances.
You know what, Donald? Why don't we use that as our topic for our next discussion?
Very good.
That sounds like a great idea. Okay. Then with that, we will conclude this part four Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Donald Davis. Today is Thursday, January 26th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Donald, thank you so very much.